to the port of Trieste near Italy's northeastern border with Slovenia, where the oil is delivered through the Transalpine pipeline to two other Russian-owned refineries in Germany. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the political bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
French cement giant Lafarge has lost their final appeal and will undergo a high-profile trial in a precedent-setting case which could force Western corporations to stop turning a blind eye to terrorism. Lafarge will be tried for complicity in crimes against humanity in Syria. They are accused of working with Daesh terrorist group for years in northern Syria, with the concrete produced in their factory used in battlefield infrastructure, which terrorists needed to keep the unrest going. They will be tried for financing terrorism, for allegedly paying 13 million euros to terrorist groups from 2010 to 2014, supposedly to keep their factories safe. They will also be charged for endangering the lives of others, for putting its 11 Syrian employees at risk. The original suit was brought by French NGO Sherpa on behalf of the workers.
We were surprised by the decision of the Court de Cassation. And this decision is really a victory because we were a bit worried that crimes against humanity would be dropped. But the fact also that on top of that, there is endangering life of workers that has been maintained is really, I mean, a double victory. So we are super happy, even though we have to remember that it's been 6 years.
After the scandal broke, Lafarge was merged with Swiss giant Holcim, but 8 Lafarge executives will now face justice.
It's the first time that a court decided on crimes against humanity, the first time it's on the mother company for the activities of its subsidiary, especially a subsidiary abroad and foreign workers. It's super interesting for access to justice for victims around the globe. And maybe opening, you know, new avenues for the victims of globalization around the world.
Leaked testimony from the Lafarge executives reveals that the French Foreign Ministry knew the entire time, telling Lafarge to hold on and that everything would work out. The case will likely drag on for years, but longtime political heavyweight and former foreign minister Laurent Fabius may be called on to testify. In 2012, he infamously said that al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, was, quote, doing good things on the ground, and likely with Lafarge's concrete. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
The drama theatre of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found two more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene, and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in. It's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder. At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement. But told me his team had only recovered three bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick, due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theatre at a field kitchen. None survived, they said. This is Alexander. He says he was sheltering in a basement nearby and came to the theatre the morning after the explosion.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are three floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theatre. Outside, beside the kitchen, there were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside. That's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
There is a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle on the ground here in Ukraine. There's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theatre as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theatre. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily, the Sunday Times Rich List. In this country, it says 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over.
It clearly shows that the capitalist system is not working. And obviously, we are celebrating that there are so many more millionaires who have more than doubled or tripled their wealth in the last 2 years, while the poor have become fairly even poorer.
Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife.
Evidently, someone of his wealth has no understanding of the crisis that a majority of the people are facing. We have 4 million people going to food banks, and the the crisis, the cost of living crisis, is becoming very significant. By the end of the year, the ordinary people, the poorer sections of the community, may be even in more difficulty, while Mr. Rishi Sunak is laughing all the way to the bank.
The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty.
I believe it's not fair, particularly the way we found out, suddenly, out of the blue.
I don't feel particular resentment at people who have money, as long as they do their job and do their job well. No one would have known had not it been highlighted recently.
First published in 1989, the Sunday Times Rich List bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men.
At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Purizep, London.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Because American tax dollars pay for 20% of Israeli regime's entire military budget, the bullet or the gun used to kill Shireen could even been purchased from U.S. weapons manufacturers with Americans' own money. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Phyllis Penis and Richard Falk, writers. This article is published under the heading, Why Americans Have a Special Responsibility in the Killing of Shireen Abu Aghele. Stay tuned for more. Shireen Abu Aghele was an Al Jazeera correspondent for the past 25 years. She was known and respected throughout the Arab world for her brave, honest reporting of the Palestinian struggle. On May 11th, she was shot and killed by an Israeli regime sniper while covering an Israeli raid on the Palestinian refugee camp outside Jenin. Abu Aghele's killing in the Israeli-occupied West Bank was shocking, but hardly unusual. According to the Palestinian Journalists Syndicate, she was the 86th journalist to be killed while covering the Zionist regime's oppression since the Zionist regime first occupied the West Bank, Gaza, and East al-Quds in 1967. But the killing of Shirin Abu Aqile is part of a longer pattern of the Zionist regime's violence and collective punishment, not just against journalists, but against all Palestinians committed with impunity and rationalized by trumped-up security concerns. The depth of this abuse was once again made shockingly visible after the killing itself, when the Zionist regime's police attacked a funeral procession carrying Shirin's body to the church. They threw Palestinian flags to the ground and violently beat mourners, including pallbearers, who nearly dropped the casket. The killing of Shirin and the assault on the funeral procession demonstrated once again the structural nature of the Zionist regime's racism and violence against Palestinians. As Amnesty International describes it, the Zionist regime's regular violations of Palestinians' rights are not accidental repetitions of offenses, but part of an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination. There is no serious question that Abu Aqile was deliberately killed by an Israeli regime sniper. She was wearing a helmet and a blue protective vest marked press and surrounded by other journalists when the group was fired on. She was shot in the head and killed. Another Palestinian journalist was shot and seriously injured. As so often happens, the Zionist regime officials immediately tried to blame the Palestinians. The Zionist regime's officials, from Prime Minister Naftali Bennett on down, made unconvincing claims that Palestinian gunmen were responsible for the killing. Within hours, field workers for the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem easily refuted the Zionist regime's baseless claims. By the time the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, met with the Zionist regime's war minister, Benny Gantz, on May 17th, Tel Aviv had largely pulled back from its claims of Palestinian culpability. The Zionist regime's press claimed that Gantz had indicated Israel welcomed an investigation of Shirin's killing, but that claim flew in the face of reports that Israel had already decided it would not investigate because questioning the Zionist regime's troops as potential suspects would provoke opposition and controversy within the IDF and Israeli society in general. Such a pattern of denial is but one aspect of a broader pattern of oppression that is much more pervasive. The Zionist regime itself makes no secret of this. The regime's own Basic Law of 2018 explicitly gives only Jewish citizens of the occupied Palestinian territories, not Palestinian citizens, the right of self-determination. Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, along with B'Tselem, have concluded that this pattern constitutes the crime of apartheid. This international crime and its associated human rights violations and war crimes has continued for decades, while political, diplomatic, economic, and military support from the United States goes forward unconditionally. Washington sends more than $3.8 billion every year directly to the Zionist regime's military, most of it used to purchase U.S.-made weapon systems, ammunition, and more. This makes the U.S. complicit in the Zionist regime's criminal wrongdoing. International engagement is crucial. The International Criminal Court has the authority to add the killing of Shirin Abu Aqile and attacks on Palestinian journalists to its existing investigations of the Zionist regime's crimes. A variety of UN bodies could also respond by issuing reports that offer policy recommendations. Calls for an independent, credible investigation need to include a focus on United States' responsibility. Biden administration officials and some members of Congress have called for an investigation of Abu Aghele's killing. That's welcome, but hardly sufficient. The Zionist regime has a long history of conducting its own investigations and virtually all result in impunity for the Zionist regime's military forces. High-ranking military officials and political decision-makers are never even scrutinized. People in the United States should insist on more. Why? Above all, because American-owned tax dollars pay for 20% of the Zionist regime's entire military budget. The bullet or gun used to kill Shireen could have even been purchased from U.S. weapons manufacturers with Americans' own money. The Leahy Law's restrictions on military aid is unequivocal. No assistance shall be furnished, it says, to any unit of the security forces of a foreign country if the Secretary of State has credible information that such unit has committed a gross violation of human rights. Credible information, including from the Zionist regime's leading human rights organization and five respected journalists standing with Shireen Abu Aghele when she was killed, indicates she was shot in cold blood. If that isn't sufficient, the U.S. State Department should propose an independent UN-based fact-finding team to prepare a report. Militarism is on the rise, both in the United States and around the world. Maybe the brutal killing of Shireen Abu Aghele, a U.S. citizen as well as a proud Palestinian born in Al-Quds, and the police attack on mourners grieving her death will provide an impetus toward rethinking Washington's unconditional support of the Zionist regime's lawlessness.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Another massacre in the U.S., 21 killed, including 19 children. This is the eighth mass shooting in the U.S. this year so far, and it's only the month of May. Why do mass shootings in the U.S. take place in the first place, more so than any other country in the world? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will take a look at why there is not a strong enough appetite or will from U.S. lawmakers, perhaps, either whether it's Republicans or Democrats, to put an end to this wave of violence, unless what's inscribed in the Second Amendment or the powerful NRA gun lobby are the main obstacles in reaching that. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us is David Swanson, is the director of World Beyond War, who joins us from Charlottesville.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. So I'm going to start with a question from you, Gerald Horn, and ask you for a reaction to what has happened, because it's obviously very depressing and very shocking that this has happened yet again in the U.S.
It's horrible, it's terrible, but it's also predictable. It's predictable because, number one, the United States operates under an archaic and antiquated constitution from the 18th century, during the era of the acceleration of the invasion of European settlers, who thought that they needed weapons in order to massacre Native Americans to take their land and to import more enslaved Africans, and needing weapons to keep them in line. And as you suggested, there's a Second Amendment that tends to validate that. But since then, you have this point that the right-wing movement in this country has latched onto that, because the right-wing movement in this country says that there should be no change in the antiquated interpretation of the Second Amendment, because it might be necessary at some point in the 21st century, for example, for their movement to overthrow a government that they don't approve of. And then this industry, the arms industry, is a very profitable industry. It has been described as perpetrating an iron river of weapons into Mexico, which has really been very helpful to certain kinds of drug cartels, for example. They're meeting in Houston, Texas, as I speak, and there are about 55,000 members of the National Rifle Association, which is one of the most powerful grassroots organizations in this country. And then I think that we should not distinguish the point that this movement is based upon a white supremacy, based upon this idea that those defined as white have a virtual and veritable divine right to rule over everyone else in this country. And I would also say that when you have a foreign policy of the United States which privileges this war, which routinely is involved in massacres of people in Afghanistan over the past two or three decades, or in Iraq in recent years, and other sites too numerous to mention,
okay,
that it leads to the cheapening of life. And that cheapening of life has now returned with a vengeance back to the United States of America.
So what do you think, David Swatson? You have different dynamics involved here, of which, due to lack of time, I'd like to see how you can put this into perspective for us. On the one hand, you have the lawmakers, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. It seems like Democrats are more pro control of the situation in terms of gun control, for example, rather than Republicans. At the same time, you have what's been called the NRA, which, you know, like Gerald Horn said there, they're a powerful lobby group. What does that exactly mean? Can you put these things that are pulling against what should be the prevention of the loss of life?
Well, I agree with every word that Professor Horn said there. There are structural problems and there are cultural problems. There are nations on this planet with similar cultures that have fixed the problem to an extraordinary extent structurally by banning guns. And the reason that this doesn't happen in Washington, D.C. is principally that they have legalized bribery and turned it into campaign contributions and made it perfectly acceptable so that politicians are openly bought and paid for. They also have this system of two parties in which, as on many issues, on this issue, one party, the Republicans, are openly and strongly against preventing gun proliferation, and the other party claims to be for doing something, but always manages to have a handful of its members against its supposed mission, even though it has the majority. and prioritizes keeping in place archaic rules like the filibuster that require it to have a supermajority that it doesn't have. And so it will use these tragedies as campaign material. Elect even more of us, and we'll do even more than the nothing that we've done so far, rather than taking action to do something about it. And you do have a culture that's been saturated with acceptance of violence. You have the U.S. government through, in this case, the U.S. Navy, funding programs in schools like the one attended by the latest shooter, to entice those who can't afford college, because college has outpriced many people in this country, to enter a program called ROTC, where they're trained to shoot guns. Very often, these shooters in high schools have been through these programs, have been trained by the U.S. government. In fact, the famous one in Florida was wearing the T-shirt from the junior ROTC when he shot up his classmates. And very disproportionately, mass shooters across the United States are veterans of the U.S. military, of U.S. wars. And so there is a culture of violence at home and abroad that creates these vicious cycles. It's a society saturated in both violence and guns. And unfortunately, we don't have a political system that seems capable of dealing with it, unless we see a mass uprising of nonviolent action. And of course, the people of the United States are the least likely people in the world to do such a thing.
Gerald Horn, when looking through and sifting through some of the points that could have been addressed in this program, one of the things that stood out is a tweet by this one particular person, which was pretty striking when I read it, and it said, in retrospect, Sandy Hook marked the end of the U.S. gun control debate. Once America decided killing children was bearable, it was over. Now, that itself is deep in the way that it impacted at least a point of view of such for me. But then when you take a look at what could be more, even more impactful would be when you have the use of guns and how it has killed politicians. Martin Luther King, for example, Kennedy, for example, and yet we're still looking at this being an issue in the U.S. So obviously there doesn't seem to be enough of an appetite, willpower, or initiative, or whatever you'd like to call it, for this to end. How can this be channeled in order to reach a solution?
Well, that is the question, is it not? But one has to say that when you have these formidable, profound issues in the United States of America, what has helped to change the calculus has been international pressure. That's the reason why slavery ended. That's the reason why U.S. apartheid, or Jim Crow as it has been called, began to retreat. That is why the United States was ultimately driven out of Vietnam in the 1970s, for example. And I dare say that because of the formidable nature of this so-called white American population, which unites across class lines, whether people want to acknowledge it or not, and is determined to hold on to power by any means necessary. Recall that it was only a few days ago that you had this racist massacre in Buffalo, New York, where 10 black people were killed at a store. The massacre perpetrator was motivated by this idea that the demographics of the United States are changing, that people not defined as white are becoming the majority, and he was determined to overturn that by his own crude action. And so we need more international pressure against the United States, not least because even those who consider themselves to be well-intentioned in the so-called white majority oftentimes have an inadequate analysis, which leads to inadequate prescriptions, which then leads us on this vicious cycle back to killing 10-year-old children in a classroom.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
NRA is going to be coming to Texas in a matter of days, from what we understand, David Swanson. You're going to have a number of politicians speaking there. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, we understand, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, and Donald Trump. One thing he did when he was in office was, based on some of the things I'm reading here, reversing an Obama-era policy that had to that was dealing with restricting gun purchases by people, and deemed by the Social Security Administration to be mentally unable to manage their affairs. He reversed that. So that's just a reflection of how even former U.S. president looked at the matter. Why is there such a divide when it comes to U.S. politicians or lawmakers, I should say?
You know, when you started to mention a tweet, I thought you might be going toward a recent tweet prior to this latest massacre by the governor of Texas, pushing people in Texas to buy more guns because they were shamefully in second place behind California. There's a culture of love for guns. It's not a necessary evil. They're celebrated. The more guns, the better. And it's a cultural identity, a partisan political identity. In the hour before we were speaking, saw that same Texas governor have a press conference interrupted by the Democrat who had run for governor against him, demanding that something be done about guns. This a complete, almost worthless, sellout corporate moderate Democrat candidate, but even he willing to say something about guns, at least until he can get himself into office. You have a congressional race, a Democratic primary happening right now, the votes being counted in Texas, between a Democrat who's, you know, worthless on most issues but willing to take a stand on guns, and the incumbent Democrat who's absolutely against doing anything about guns, and you have the Democratic leadership in Washington, D.C. doing everything they can to keep that incumbent in office, even while claiming that they are the ones against guns. And so you have this endless hypocritical compromising from the Democrats, and this cultural celebration of guns as a wonderful, heroic things. If you don't have weapons of war in your house, the government is going to come get you. You know, this government that can't tie its own shoes. And so there is a cultural divide, and there is, a political logjam.
Yeah, and some of the stats that I'm looking at, David Swanson, which points to the question that I want to ask you, I'm sorry, Gerald Horn, is the fact that, so you have these massacres, eight of them so far, by the way, and it's only May, as I mentioned in the intro, people are dying from gun violence on a daily basis in the U.S., daily basis. Now, this particular source talks about 45,000, somewhat, maybe 45,800 injuries that include deaths, but it doesn't get into the complete number. It says 2020 is the furthest of this database that they have. But anyways, if it is such an issue, which it is, this gun culture and how guns lead to deaths and people are using it to kill each other, why isn't it highlighted more throughout the media in the U.S. on a weekly basis, I don't know, on news channels, or more education perhaps on it in schools, et cetera? Is that happening and still not working?
It is happening to a degree. It needs to happen more, but I have to repeat what I said a moment or two ago. The ultimate problem is the fact that this gun culture comes from the bloody history of the United States of America, the history of a European invasion, where the people who were not only rich, but the people who were poor and were settlers and defined as white, were armed so that they could kill Native Americans. I'm sitting here in Texas. 200 years ago, this land was teeming with indigenous populations, particularly the Comanches. They've all been liquidated, exterminated. And so that helped to create this culture. And then, as I said before, you have to keep the black population in line, which is still happening to this very day. Many of our liberal friends buy into the mythology about the Constitution and the so-called sacred founding of the United States in 1776. which prevents them from dealing and grappling honestly with this bloody history. Instead, they blame political parties, which of course are ultimately dependent upon this same majority white electorate, which I've just excoriated. And so until we are able to deal honestly with this history, we will be continually
let's go with that line that you're talking about. Dave Swanson, last question. God forbid that any type of social crisis, which the U.S. is teetering on, breaks out in terms of a civil unrest of a massive scale, large in numbers in the U.S., where you have guns almost outnumbering the people. Isn't the U.S. government worried about something like that happening? 30 seconds.
I don't think there's a grave danger of that happening. I do think there is a grave danger of these shootings continuing and multiplying and of the continuation of nothing being done in Washington, D.C. But in terms of a violent uprising in the United States, I don't think it's much more likely than a nonviolent one, which is what we actually need, but is extremely unlikely due to the disempowerment in people's own minds.
Thank you, David Swanson, director of the World Beyond War at Charlottesville. Darrell Horn, thank you, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston from Houston, Texas. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tabwe and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio. Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In United States, a dizzying week featured Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican leader, caught lying, and another lawmaker, Marjorie Taylor Greene, grilled under oath about her role in the 6th of January attack on the Capitol. The article you're about to hear has been written by the congressional correspondent for the New York Times, Jonathan Weisman. The piece is titled, For Trump's GOP, Crossing Lines Has Few Consequences. There was a time in the United States Capitol when lines mattered, and when they were crossed, the consequences were swift and severe. Speaker Jim Wright, a Democrat, lost his job in 1989 amid charges of corruption and profiteering. Almost a decade later, Speaker Newt Gingrich, a Republican, lost his job after disappointing midterm elections. Newt Gingrich's expected successor, Robert Livingston, then admitted he had violated the public's trust by having an extramarital affair, even as he demanded President Bill Clinton's resignation for having an affair with a White House intern, and bowed out on his own. More recently, in rapid succession, Senator Al Franken of Minnesota and Representative John Conyers of Michigan, both Democrats, were forced to exit Congress amid charges of sexual harassment during the hashtag MeToo era. On the Republican side, Representative Blake Farenthold of Texas, Patrick Meehan of Pennsylvania, and Trent Franks of Arizona were also driven out of office by allegations of sexual impropriety. Yet when the House Republican leader, Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, was shown to have lied about his response to the deadliest assault on the Capitol in centuries, and President Donald Trump's culpability for that attack, there was little expectation that the consequences would be either swift or severe, or that there would be any consequences at all. Dissembling is not a crime, but doing so to conceal a wholesale reversal on a matter as serious as an attack on the citadel of democracy and the possible resignation of a president would once have been considered career-ending for a politician in the United States, particularly one who aspires to the highest position in the House of Representatives. Not so for a Republican in the age of Donald Trump, when Kevin McCarthy's brand of lie was nothing particularly new. Maybe it was just a Thursday. On Friday, another House member, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, said under oath at an administrative law hearing in Atlanta, Georgia, that she could not recall having advocated Donald Trump imposed martial law to stop the transfer of power to Joseph R. Biden Jr., a position that would seem difficult to forget. It's a tragic indictment of the political process these days, and the Republican Party of late, that truth doesn't matter anymore. Words don't matter. Everybody can be elastic in areas where once viewed as concrete, said Mark Sanford, a former Republican governor of South Carolina who lied to the public about his whereabouts when he was pursuing an extramarital affair in South America, and was censured by the State House of Representatives. You cross lines now, and there are no longer any consequences. Mark Sanford's political comeback as a Republican member of the House ended when he crossed the one line that still does matter in his party. He condemned Donald Trump as intolerant and untrustworthy. Donald Trump called him nothing but trouble, and Mark Sanford was defeated in a primary in 2018. It was Donald Trump himself who showed just how few consequences there could be for transgressions that once seemed beyond the pale for the nation's leaders in 2016, when he survived the release of leaked audio in which he boasted of sexually assaulting women, then went on to win the presidency. In the year afterward, he survived two impeachment trials on charges of pressuring Ukraine for his own political gain and of inciting the Capitol riot, and he continues to spread the lie that the 2020 election was stolen from him. Those episodes were vivid proof, if any were needed, that tribalism and party loyalty now outweigh any notion of integrity or even steadfast policy beliefs. But if there were any questions about whether the end of Donald Trump's presidency would begin to restore old mores and guardrails, the past months have put those thoughts to rest. Last month, Representative Madison Cawthorn, Republican of North Carolina, angered fellow Republicans by saying lawmakers he looked up to had invited him to parties involving sex and cocaine. The allegations drew condemnation from Kevin McCarthy, who told Republican lawmakers that Madison Cawthorn had later admitted they were untrue, though the House leader stopped short of punishing him. In Missouri, Eric Greitens, who resigned from the governorship in 2018 amid charges of sexual impropriety. When his ex-wife accused him of domestic violence in a sworn affidavit last month, he pressed on, near the top of the polls, saying she was being manipulated by Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader, and Karl Rove, President George W. Bush's former political advisor. The Greitens campaign has received tremendous support from donors and patriots across the country who see the deception and lies peddled by establishment rhinos. or Republicans in name only, said Dylan Johnson, his campaign manager. Since they launched those unfounded attacks in the last few weeks, the campaign has seen an exponential increase in the rate of donations, sign-ups and engagement. Kevin McCarthy's latest travails with the truth are reminiscent of the last time he had the speakership in his grasp and instructive about how Donald Trump has changed the political landscape in America. Representative Charlie Crist of Florida, who was a Republican governor of his state before he became a Democratic congressman, listed that honesty wasn't important today as it was when Abraham Lincoln was extolled as Honest Abe, and a myth grew up around George Washington, admitting he had chopped down a cherry tree because he could not tell a lie. Charlie Crist of Florida is now seeking the governorship as a Democrat, and he said on Friday that if he won a contested primary, he planned to make honesty central to his campaign to unseat the current governor of Florida, Republican Ron DeSantis. It already is part of this campaign, he said. It needs to be, and it should be. It goes to the core essence of integrity. For Republicans, the ultimate arbiter of lines not to be crossed and the consequences to be paid remains Donald Trump. For now, the former president signaled all is fine with Kevin McCarthy. I think it's all a big compliment, frankly, he told the Wall Street Journal on Friday. If Donald Trump decides the House leader, Kevin McCarthy, must pay for his prevarications or for the truth he tried to hide, the price is still could be high. Take it from the one who knows, Mark Sanford. Mark Sanford says, "We live in very strange times in politics," he said that he was hustling to his son's wedding rehearsal dinner. "I hope they can self-correct, but I worry that they can't."